here thinks that big tech is too big, raise your hand.
Some of them spend 5 hours a day just on TikTok and then 10 hours a day on everything.
Narratives about tech determinism that suggest that tech just follows some inevitable law and we just have to be in its wake adapting.
The faster the algorithm learns how to help us train the algorithm to train us, to train the algorithm, to train us, to train the algorithm, to train us.
Chinese tech giants are not dragging the Chinese government to independent courts and fighting back. They are capitulating. That is not happening in the democratic West.
We're quite clear that big tech power and liberal democracy are not compatible.
So let's do some ranking. Let's have some fun. Let's try and rank the instances of the algorithm organizing the world on a scale of least concerning to most concerning. So we've got things like Netflix, dating apps, et cetera, et cetera. What's the least concerning manifestation of algorithmic management in the 21st century?
Okay, so I mean, my guilty secret as a sort of critic of algorithmic management and organization is that I feel quite protective of my sort of curated algorithm on sort of like YouTube or on Netflix, for example, because it, you know, suggests to me good things that are along the lines of things that I might like. And even though I have a sort of critical relationship to it, I think that it probably does sort of flatten my experience somewhat. I mean, it did occur to me recently on election night, a friend of ours, a colleague at Navarra Media, had to explain to me who Charlie XCX is and what Brat Summer is all about, which many people that go over their heads and many people clearly hasn't. But I mean, this was, you know, I was way behind the curve on this. I think probably next up would be, I mean, you mentioned dating apps. So some dating apps, some people may not know, but some dating apps have as their sort of USP that they are going to give you a algorithmically decided sort of percentage score of your likelihood of a match with this person. Now, it used to be the case that you would go on a dating app and someone might say, nobody under 5'10" contact me. That's very rude indeed. But I would go on and find people saying, do not contact me if you're below 90%, which is just seems wild to me.
90% of what?
90% match. Do not contact me if the algorithm says that you are less than 90% likely to be a match with me. And people take it like really seriously, which, I mean, says something interesting about intimacy in the 21st century, I think. Probably next up, I would say something like...
So that's not bad?
I think that's pretty bad.
But it's not too bad?
Well, I think there is worse.
Okay.
Is where I'm going with this. So, you know...
That strikes me as pretty bad.
If you think that's bleak, strap in. Next up, I would say, so like algorithmic management at work, this is kind of the area that I've looked at the most. I'll give just one example, because there are lots of examples of how this works, but one example is I spoke to a worker called Lorenzo, and he works not actually far from here. He works in a big distribution hub. It's kind of outside of Heathrow, and this is a place, it's sort of above the supermarkets, so food comes in from all over the world, and his job is to organize it, and it's going to go out to different supermarkets across London. And his day starts with a text message that tells him whether or not to come into work. Remember that, because I'll come back to it. He goes to work, he signs in, he gets given a wearable scanner. He calls it a wristwatch, but it's actually a really big, kind of like a half brick that kind of strapped to his forearm. It's quite heavy, and he has to lift it up thousands of times a day. And it's attached to a scanner on his finger, like a ring, so that he doesn't ever have to put it down when he's picking up boxes to optimize his movements. And he sort of presses and scans barcodes all day and moves this thing around. And then he clocks out at the end of the day. And what transpires is that all day this has been tracking him. It's been tracking his, you know, the boxes he's been moving, the crates he's been pulling around, his productivity. It's been tracking his downtime. If he takes time to go out to the toilet, tracks him then as well. Gives him a negative score for it. And then, you know, at some point in the night, what's going to happen is he's going to get an algorithmically decided text message sent to his phone that he's going to wake up to, and it will tell him on that text message his shift is either confirmed or cancelled based on his productivity score from the previous day. And because he's an agency worker, they can do that. And so he knows he has to work through the day to, let's say, 90%. He has no sense whilst he's working whether he's on target or not. So he has no choice but to work as fast as he can, because nobody's going to come and tell him, you're doing fine, you could probably slow down a little bit, like, don't break your back over it. That's not going to happen. What might happen is if things are looking very bleak, then a supervisor might come out from an office somewhere, they're not sort of present on the shop floor, and say, here is a very big list of numbers on the printout that's completely indecipherable, but I'm telling you that this says, pick up the pace. So I'd say that's pretty bad, and maybe even a bit worse than being rejected on the basis of of my compatibility on Match.com.
My first book was called The Happiness Hypothesis. It was about ancient wisdom. And over again, what I realized is a life spent on social media, not screens, not artificial, life spent with a lot of social media teaches us to act in ways that are the exact opposite of ancient wisdom on so many levels. So the ancients tell us, judge not, lest ye be judged. Be more forgiving, be slower to judge, quicker to forgive. What does social media do? A life on Twitter says, judge now, right now, because if you don't judge right now, you're going to be judged for not judging. And we don't need context, just slam this person publicly. It's performative. And so a life of fragmented attention, not still and meditating and thinking, life of quick judgment and anger, it doesn't affect everyone. Sure, that's true. Even if it didn't affect a majority, it would still be the biggest crisis we could possibly face for our kids for this reason. I recently found out, in the U.S., we give warning labels on toys that have small parts, choking hazard, or that have a string. Do you know how many people choke to death in America every year? About a dozen. Look at TikTok. TikTok has the choking challenge. I can't get exact numbers, but it's something like 20 or 30 documented cases of people who kids who choke themselves to death just from TikTok, one TikTok challenge. So we don't say, oh, well, you know, most kids aren't choking to death, therefore it's okay. We say, wait a second. If dozens of kids are choking to death from this consumer product, we pull it from the market. If it's a defective product harming children, we pull it from the market. And the death toll from TikTok is not just a few dozen. It's hundreds and hundreds if you include the suicide promotion stuff. Just sextortion, as Catherine was saying, once you give your kid a phone, they're going to be in contact with men all over the world and with sextortion rings that are going to try to get naked photos of them, especially if they're boys. When a boy sends a nude photo of himself to what he thinks is a girl, and then a sextortion ring says, oh, we got you now. We know all your friends. We're going to shame you unless you give us money. And then he gives them money to say, we need more. And then he kills himself. That's not mistaking correlation for causation. That is, social media caused the death of this child. It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't on social media. And even if this was only happening to a few hundred kids a year, it's a lot more than that. But even if we had only a few hundred suicides a year from social media, it would be worth a Surgeon General warning. It's so much worse than any consumer product we show our kids. Now, is social media responsible for the huge increase that I've been saying? There's an academic debate about that. Some people say I'm wrong. I think Emily would say no, social media didn't cause the big increase. Well, let's bear in mind, the big increase we're talking about is not about a few hundred kids. It's about a few hundred million kids. And so what we're dealing with here is the possibility that a few companies, primarily Meta and TikTok and Snap, that a few companies have at least damaged the mental health of hundreds of millions of children and led to thousands of additional suicides. So yeah, it's not most people, even if most kids are fine. Are you going to let your kid use a product that's going to double or triple their chance of depression and their chance of suicide? I can't believe we're even having this argument this late.
AI mirrors don't just reveal, they magnify. Their algorithms are never neutral, never perfectly flat and polished. They increase certain select features of our reality while diminishing others. One of the things we know that they amplify or magnify is the bias that's already living in our data through our own discriminatory patterns. Our tendency, for example, to undertreat in America Black people in the medical system. When you train a hospital algorithm that's supposed to automatically triage patients and give the sickest patients the most attention and care, if you're not careful, what the algorithm will do is actually repeat the pattern of bias or even amplify it against Black patients in the hospital and take the sickest Black patients and deprioritize them for care and elevate healthier white patients on the list, right? That's what this model that these researchers found was doing in American hospitals. And not by design. The developers of the algorithm didn't want that outcome, but they didn't realize the power of the AI mirror to magnify the racial bias that was already running through all the medical data that we had. We know that even the newest tools have this potential. So GPT-4 has been shown to perpetuate racial and gender biases in healthcare. For example, taking women who present with symptoms of a blood clot and in comparison with men who present with the same symptoms, being more likely to diagnose the women as having anxiety or panic disorder rather than a blood clot, right? Those are very dangerous errors that humans make and that women already die from. We don't want our AI tools to be magnifying these kinds of scenarios, right? We know that these models also distort. This was a study by Bloomberg showing that when you asked for a representation of women doctors, the image model that produced this actually returned only 7% of women. But in reality, 39% of doctors are women. So again, it's not just that it's reproducing our bias, it's distorting what's already here, right? Women are 40% of the medical workforce as doctors, and yet the image model is only showing women as 7%. Or if you can see these are images of a person at social services, but they all have dark skin. Apparently, white people don't use social services. That's a surprise. This is a productive person. All productive people are white men wearing ties. One Black man here in the corner, no women, right? These are not reality. These are not even, you know, a reality that we might wish were better. This is just a distortion. Attractive people all look the same, right? They're all young, light-skinned. They look like sisters. Toys in Iraq, right? You get this, if you can see it. Toy soldiers with guns is all the model can think of. Right? And when we try to correct these distortions, we often don't do much better. So some of you may be familiar with the example of Google trying to tune its models to be less biased. And then when you asked for an illustration of a 1943 German soldier, you got a young Asian woman and a young Black man as Nazi soldiers, right? It's just, there's a disconnect here.
Word that's missing from the debate, really, is capitalism. You know, this is a way of doing these kinds of industries, and the decision was taken to leave it to the free operation of the market within a particular context of data protection law and all of the usual guardrails around competition policy, etc., were relatively distant, so that the companies were free to develop this business model, and they naturally developed technologies that tended to be addictive. That tended to be, if they're advertising models, what you want is a form of advertising which is very effective at manipulating humans. And targeted advertising, you know, which is based on, maybe it's based on 1,000 data points about every person in this room, in 5 years may be based on 10,000 data points and better behavioral knowledge about you. This advertising is going to be more effective at manipulating your behavior. So without the guardrails in data protection and in all of these other spheres, we're going to find our way to that position. And you know, the competitive position just locks people in to this. We all want to leave Facebook. We all want to moderate our behavior, but it's just very difficult to do that.
I shall start with free air television, commercial television, especially in the United States. Now think about it. They were a very strange kind of thing, of good, because they could not be commodified. And they were more like a sunset. How can you make people pay for it? So what happened was their broadcast was used to magnetize the attention of the audience before selling the attention of the audience to advertisers. When there is a will, there's a capitalist way of commodifying things. And then advertisers use the access to people's arrested attention to do something quite audacious, to enlist emotions, which had escaped commodification so far, to the task of deepening commodification. Let me give you an example, because that sounds a bit complicated. It isn't really. I don't know how many of you have watched that great, splendid serial, Mad Men, with Don Draper being the archetypal, brilliant advertiser at the heart of Mad Men. There was this scene when he's coaching his protege, a young woman called Peggy, on how to think of a chocolate bar, a Hershey bar. Draper caught the spirit of the times when he said to her, "Peggy, you don't buy a Hershey bar for a couple of ounces of chocolate." And I'm quoting here, "You buy it to recapture the feeling of being loved, the feeling that you knew when your dad bought you one for mowing the lawn." So this is it. It's the commodification of nostalgia. The nostalgia that was never commodified is being used by Draper, okay, in order to hyper-commodify a chocolate bar. That was a turning point of capitalism. Draper, I mean the fictional, the person who's writing the Draper role, was putting her or his finger on a fundamental mutation in the DNA of capitalism. Efficiently manufacturing things that people craved, that people already craved, was no longer enough. With the rise of the big conglomerates in the 1920s, 30s, and especially after the Second World War, the rise of what John Kenneth Galbraith, that wonderful economist of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, he described that variety of capitalism that emerged from the rise of the conglomerates, especially after the Second World War, with the heavy role of government in regulating the global economy with Bretton Woods and so on. He called it the technostructure. What changed with the technostructure was that simply manufacturing things was not enough. The point of manufacturing was not to satiate existing needs. Manufacturing had become so mass-produced, so efficient, that manufacturing commodities had to go hand in hand with manufacturing the desire for commodities. Now, we are all familiar with how commercial television works. This is the linchpin between the technostructure's capacity to produce all sorts of commodities and its capacity to manufacture our desire for those commodities. Then, once the internet, which had begun life as a planned system, came out of the military and the academic market, the universities, once, however, it was cannibalized, it was taken over by commercial conglomerates, the internet changed the principles of advertising. It morphed them into something quite different. Instead of having Don Draper or the Drapers of the world, the advertisers, coming up with concepts for commodifying our nostalgia in order to recommodify commodities, the internet allowed for the creation of algorithmic systems permitting person-specific targeting of advertisements that television could not support. We're all familiar with a kind of person-specific, algorithmic-based advertising targeting of Google, of Facebook, of TikTok, and so on. Now, at first, the first algorithms, what they did was something quite straightforward. They identified clusters of users, people with similar tastes, with similar search patterns in Google, in the Google engine, similar preferences. Those algorithms grouped them together to complete their searches, to make them more efficient, to suggest books, records to them, to us, films. But then came a major breakthrough. At some point, the algorithms ceased to be passive. Once algorithms could evaluate their own performance, the algorithms, began to behave like agents. They began to monitor and react to the outcomes of their own actions. At that point, they began not only to affect the people they surveyed, but additionally to affect themselves by the way people were affected by them. Before we knew it, the task of instilling desires in our soul was taken from the Don Drapers and the Peggy's of Mad Men, from human beings running the advertising industry. And that task was now handed over to the Alexas and to the Siris, to all those talking algorithms, whether you have an iPhone, an Amazon Alexa, a Google Assistant, whatever. Now, those who question how real the threat of artificial intelligence is to white-collar jobs should ask themselves, what exactly does Alexa or Siri do? Ostensibly, Alexa is a home-based mechanical servant. In reality, Alexa or Siri or Google Assistant or any of those assistants, they are just the front end of a gigantic artificial intelligence cloud-based network that millions of us, if not billions of us, are training several billion times every second as we chat on the phone or move and do things while carrying our mobile phone. The system, this cloud-based algorithmic system, learns our preferences and habits. And as it gets to know us, it develops an uncanny capacity to surprise us with, you know, good recommendations about books and so on, even with ideas that intrigue us. Before we realize it, the system has acquired substantial powers to guide our choices, effectively to command us. With cloud-based Alexa-like devices or applications in the role once occupied by human beings like Don Draper, we find ourselves in the most dialectical of infinite regresses. Think of what it is that we do. In real time, perpetually, we train the algorithm so the algorithm knows how to train us to do the things that are in the interest of the owners. And the more we do this, the faster the algorithm learns how to help us train the algorithm to train us, to train the algorithm, to train us, to train the algorithm, to train us, and so on and so forth.
I mean, I think if you believe that power to be legitimate, to be democratically legitimate, has to be constrained, then I think you would understand that tech companies, the big platform companies at least, have been able to grow and consolidate extraordinary power that not only rivals and sometimes in certain areas exceeds state power, but most importantly has already been shown to be able to routinely capture state power, right? And so you have unelected actors who can independently exert forces upon our lives that are comparable to state power, but they can also manipulate state power to their ends, not just through lobbying, but through even well-meaning kinds of attempts to govern technology. If you look at, in the United States, a new AI safety board that was just announced by President Biden, the names at the top of the list are all CEOs of the major tech companies. So it's a classic example of the foxes guarding the hen house. But you understand why, right? Because as you said, the regulators don't understand the tech very much. The policymakers and legislators are struggling. I've testified at Congress. I was horrified by the lack of understanding in some cases of the technology. So we're in this bind. But I want to also point out that we're in a different situation than with some of the big industrial monopolies of the 19th and 20th centuries. If you think about the Carnegies and the Rockefellers in the United States, for example, those were powers that emerged in industries like steel and oil that had a tremendous amount of power within a particular sector, right? But the AI companies are not confined to a particular area of our lives. Their power is increasingly exerted in our schools, in our GP offices, in our bedrooms, in our political media, in the public streets, right? And even upon your minds and emotions. We've never seen power with that kind of breadth. And I think that tells us that we need to heed the warnings of old political philosophers like Locke and Rousseau, who warned us against the dangers of unaccountable power and unconstrained power. And they said that there is no human dignity possible and no freedom possible with an unconstrained power, even one that promises to be benevolent, right? And I think they were right. And I think if that was true of state power, it certainly is true of the actors that are now rivaling and capturing state power. And especially now that they have reach into much more of our lives than even an absolute monarch would. What do we do about that? Just very quickly, we learn the lessons of the past. If you look at safety critical and trust critical industries like Boeing, we used to know how to regulate and incentivize those companies to innovate at the same time as care for human safety. It's a false dichotomy that regulation and innovation is a forced choice. We must have one or the other. When we regulate well, we actually get better innovation and more sustainable innovation. We can take that lesson to AI as well.
So it's not the first time in history we have big corporations that are in charge of our economies. But I think what makes these tech companies different is the multifaceted power that they wield. It is not just economic power, it is political power, it is informational power, and it is cultural power. And these companies provide many services and products that we absolutely love and have become dependent on, even addicted to, which makes it very difficult to then dismantle that power. Because increasingly we are beginning to understand that these companies do not only shape our lives and societies in beneficial ways, but extremely harmful ways. And the reason these companies have become so powerful is that we have made the choice to allow them to be so powerful. So the power of the tech companies should not only be traced to Silicon Valley, but to Washington, D.C., that has the legislative framework in place that has really enabled the growth of these companies to the prominence they have today, not only in the origin in the United States, but across the world. So because of the concentration of this power and the origin of this power of these tech companies, this power also exhibits features that are very much consistent with the American techno-libertarian worldview. So these companies moderate content online in the ways that reflects often American values that is not sensitive necessarily to the societies and values in different parts of the world where this power is also exercised. But let me now share my biggest concern here is that when, even though we are awakening now as societies, the need to repeal that power, take back control of our societies and economies, we are facing particular difficulties to do so. So this backlash has also taken over the conversation in the US. But the American Congress is having really hard time in legislating, in rewriting the laws that ultimately are shaping the way in this environment how tech companies behave. Europeans, on the other hand, have had better track record in legislating, but they are also struggling to enforce those laws. At the same time, the Chinese government is not having a hard time legislating. China has recently taken a very different view on tech companies. Ultimately, they were also set free to carry out their power the way they wanted. But there's been recently a crackdown that has been very effective. China can legislate. And when the Chinese government puts its mind to it and decides to enforce those laws are being enforced. Chinese tech giants are not dragging the Chinese government to independent courts and fighting back. They are capitulating. That is not happening in the democratic West. So what really concerns me is that we are now struggling to show that there is a liberal democratic way to govern the tech companies. And ultimately, what we are now witnessing is that our digital economies seem to be either governable by authoritarian governments or in the democratic West, they are being governed by tech companies themselves. And that, I think, is the outcome that is very difficult for anybody who believes in liberal democracy as a foundation of a digital society and human engagement to ultimately live with.
And the context of all this, of course, was a particular framework of competition law, neoliberal, if you want to call it that, which believed that the market would always do best. And we can draw a straight line from those decisions and the limitations on liability for platforms and the way that competition rules were applied to them to where we are now, which is everybody's worried about data being mined, people being manipulated, democracy being hacked. And we've reached the point where we're quite clear that big tech power and liberal democracy are not compatible. Well, one of the heartening things about the discussion tonight is that we haven't heard that old cliche that, oh, it's not possible to do this because they're global companies. If companies have assets and economic activities in your market, you can do stuff to them. So the Competition and Markets Authority has done a big investigation into the advertising market, effectively digital advertising. And one of the things they say in the small print, sounds very techie, ownership separation options should be kept on the table. That means we should always have on the table the structural separation, all of these cliche words, breaking them up.
I do not think that breaking up these companies is the solution. We do not want to sort of regulate them out of the existence. But even if we put more efforts in regulating, I don't think that is my fear. I am more worried about under-regulation or over-regulation, meaning under-regulation with the difficulty of actually enforcing. I thought there was a really interesting statistic that the year that GDPR, for instance, entered into force, and the Irish agency, as Dublin being the host for many of these tech companies, was vested with a budget of 9 million. That is the amount that the tech companies headquartered in Dublin make every 10 minutes. So the resources of these companies are so vast that I am not worried that the regulation would overpower whatever is good that these tech companies can bring to the table anytime soon.
If you look back at the beginning of the last century, what happened in the oil industry, particularly in the US, they took the decision to break up Standard Oil. Later, decisions were taken to break up big telecommunications monopolies. This is a standard procedure in markets that become so concentrated and so locked in to that concentration that structural solutions have to be considered. So it has to be on the table. I would say maybe try a chisel, not an axe. You know, you actually don't want to end up just creating thousands of tiny Facebooks with exactly the same business model and higher competitive pressures and less ability and less resource to do the content moderation and all of the other things to reduce the harm.
But do you think that, if you like, the tech titans will be under more control, more accountability?
Sure. Yeah, it's totally going to happen. We saw the U.S. Congress pass the law banning TikTok after talking about it in circles for years. They banned it within a week, from a Monday to a Friday. And I think when they get sick and tired of things enough, they're going to act very quickly. So the first thing to fall is Section 230, which is giving a sort of a waiver to online platforms from the liability of the content that they serve, a little bit along the model of the post office not being responsible for what's inside the letter because they're not opening it up and reading it. And so that's probably going to fall, I would guess, next 24 months. Certainly.
Is this the publisher question?
Yes, exactly. Again, if it's the publisher question, the term publisher comes from the stationers, and that comes from this 400-year-old metaphor and mental model. We have to throw that out. Platform is a better one and more modern. So the reason we're in this jam is because we're using things like the post office model, and the internet service provider looks like the post office or the common carrier, and common carrier referred to the carriage on trains, right, and then was poured into telecom law. So we're constantly living in the past with our mental models, and that's what got us into this jam. So I think right now we're at a period where Congress is going to wake up, or all countries are going to impose liability on limited liability, but liability on the content of what's served. And so that means Facebook and Google are going to have to police more of the content on their networks. Twitter is probably going to have to put some sort of ensure that there's no bot farm on there. There'll be robots on an individual level, but it probably won't be on the massive scale. But ultimately, where I think it needs to go, if we're going to look at, and this is the unpopular opinion, I'll end here, is that if we're going to look at what we can do as a society, to big tech, we also need to look unto ourselves and see, well, where do we need to impose individual responsibility and accountability for ourselves? So many people are looking for a solution in government or someone else to do their job for them. And that means exercising self-control. How much time are they spending online? Are they accepting their cookies because they just want the access of the content? Or do they want to adjust their cookie settings so that the cookies aren't imposed on their website, on their browser? These are things that we're no longer doing, but we need to.
Greatest danger, I think, is in narratives about tech determinism that suggest that tech just follows some inevitable law and we just have to be in its wake adapting. That's how we've gotten, I think, to some of the misaligned incentives in the tech ecosystem that we have. We're not observers. We are people who can change the future at any time. And as Ben mentioned, we have in the past, as you said, many times reached in and said, this is broken, we need to try to fix it. Now, sometimes we fix it in the wrong way, right? The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in the United States was a disaster. It was misused by the government, and we should hold governments accountable for bad regulation of tech that impinges upon our freedoms as well. But the thing is that it isn't a question about whether nations and governments will be able to fight back in the future. They can fight back now. There just is no political will to do so. And I think we have to ask a different question, which is, what are the obstacles that are holding us back? And what are the obstacles that are holding our leaders back from developing the knowledge that's needed, from listening to the many of the policy experts who in civil society who are out there with that expertise, who do try to reach political leaders and get them to listen and get shut out by the corporate leaders that don't want that to be the message. So I think we need to be able to ask the question, what do we need to change in the current status quo in order to get the future we want?